Welcome to Aware. We are dedicated to communicating information that inspires your positive growth and change. Are you interested in a peaceful planet? Are you interested in optimal health? Are you living with purpose? Are you enjoying your life? We realize each person can make a difference, and our mission is to empower your awareness. The choices that you make in every moment shape your life, and we encourage you to realize that you have your own answers and to always listen to your own truth. We invite you to stay aware. Hello and welcome to The Aware Show. I am Lisa Garr, and thank you so much for joining me. It is a true privilege and a pleasure to be here and to have you join me as well while I get to communicate all of this great information that inspires positive growth and change. So thank you for joining me. And I want to also mention that I have over 200 shows on the Gaia TV network, and that is at inspirationsongaia.com. If you just go to inspirationsongaia.com, you will see a lot of the amazing guests that I interview here on radio are also in wonderful video interviews, and you'll be able to watch them and going through some exercises and experiences as well, which is always great for you to take it to the next level and really take the information into your world. So check it out over there. All right, so talking about bringing information into our world, I have, many years ago, I experienced a near-death experience, and this was probably 17 years ago, and I've spoken about it, and I've written about it in my book, Becoming Aware. And more recently, I have heard this near-death experience as a very common phrase. If you search it on Google, you'll see something like 29 million hits. So I started looking into this further, realizing there are so many great books about the paranormal and various experiences that are beyond the known. Now, I'm loving this because there is a book that's coming out now with actual scientific evidence of the existence of life after life or precognition. And that's the name of the book. Is called Premonition, The Premonition Code. And joining me are two incredible people that have put this book into the world, which I'm very grateful for. Teresa Chung, who is joining us from the UK. She has a master's from King's College, Cambridge, and has spent the last 20 years writing best-selling books and encyclopedias about the psychic world, which is super cool. And also Dr. Julia Mossbridge, and she's joining us from San Francisco. She's a futurist trained in cognitive neuroscience. And she's a fellow at IONS, the Institute of Noetic Sciences, in many different places. And she has one of her topics is the possibility of time travel. It's one of the things I've always thought was going to be possible in my lifetime. So welcome both Julia and Teresa. Thank you for joining me.
Hello. Thank you so much, Lisa.
I should have said welcome, Julia. Hello.
Hi. Thanks for having me.
Absolutely. And welcome, Teresa. Thanks for joining us.
You can tell from our accents who's who, so that's good.
It's really great. You both don't sound a lot alike, which is terrific. So one of the things I love is that this book has been brought to us by explain to me who published the book. Tell us that first.
It's published by Watkins Media from the UK, simply because that's where I've been working recently. And I've known Julia for a few years, have interviewed her and been fascinated by her research. And Watkins Media kind of specializes in this area of supernormal publishing, which, you know, other big publishers sometimes struggle with the concept of. Mm-hmm. So, and I was fascinated by Julia's research, and I couldn't understand why it wasn't more well known. Of course, it's very, very, you know, she's a superstar in the circles that she mixes in, the scientific and academic, mm-hmm. but not outside that. And that felt very wrong to me. And this book is an effort to try and bring some of this brilliant research into the very real possibility of precognition out to the general reader in a way that we hope is accessible. And that's basically how it came about. It's an attempt to show people that books about the paranormal are not just written from a believer's perspective or someone who had an experience, because that's how these books tend to
right.
form. Somebody has an incredible experience and they write their story about it. I wanted this book, and Julie wanted this book, to show the credible science out there. I mean, there are other books which bring in the science, but they tend to be quite impenetrable and difficult to read because they're filled with jargon. Mm-hmm. And we're tried in this book to make it accessible so that everybody can kind of understand where the science is at. And talking about the science, Julie is your lady there because she knows it so well. I mean, it was quite tough for me to keep up with the science mm-hmm. when working on it. But a fantastic, fantastic opportunity.
Well, let's start off there by asking you, Julia, what exactly is precognition, or at least at the level that you are studying it?
Sure. So first I want to say, Teresa, you always say such kind words about my work, but this book wouldn't exist without Teresa trying to explain to me that when you talk with people about science, you have to do it in a way that they can understand.
Mm.
So
mm-hmm.
that's
good
really
start.
Important.
Yeah.
So precognition. Precognition is getting information, or at least defined scientifically as getting information about future events that is accurate and that cannot be picked up through other means, such as inference. So it's not precognition to decide to bring an umbrella with you as you leave the house the next day if it's raining tonight.
Right.
Right. That's just thinking. That's logic and that's inference. But it would be precognition if there's not a cloud in the sky and there's no subconscious cues, no rumblings that you might be hearing, no moisture in the air that tells you that it's going to rain and you still bring your umbrella because you just have a feeling.
Mm-hmm.
So the reason that I sort of give those two examples is because in most situations in life of what we call spontaneous precognition, which happens often in dreams or in feelings of I've just got to do this thing or I just think this is important, sort of compulsions, that there's a way in which it's very hard to determine whether it's genuine precognition or not, but we can actually test in the lab when we know that an event can't be predicted because we use a random number generator to produce the event after the behavior that we're testing has happened. So there's no way that you could, I could explain that, unpack that a little bit. But anyway.
That's why it's fascinating. Yes.
Does that make sense?
Yeah. Yes. So you can do these experiments over and over and over again and get the same results. What are the actual experiments?
Yeah, there's some standard ones I can kind of talk you through. So so one standard one is dream precognition. So that's a standard experiment that needs to be replicated more. There's only about 6 really good dream precognition studies out there right now, so there needs to be more. But the studies are like this. You take someone who you usually want to use people who already report, I remember my dreams and I have what seem to be precognitive experiences or predictions in my dreams that seem to happen the next day. So you take those people and you tell them, look, I want you to go to bed, dream, and make the intention to dream about the video that I'm going to show you tomorrow. And so the person goes to sleep and they dream. And the next day you interview them or they write down all of their dreams. You had them, you put them away so that those can't be changed. And then you use a random number generator to pick which of several videos you'll show them. So then you show them that video. So that's their experience. And
oh, so you don't know what the video is going to be.
No one on the planet knows what the video
is
going to be.
Okay.
Right. You have to make it that way because if you know as a researcher, you could give the person cues, you know, when they're telling you their dream. And you'll say, oh, yeah, you dreamt about police officers? Mm. Well, that's interesting. You know,
right?
I mean, you might not even know you're doing it. So you just have to not know. No one gets to know until you do the random number generator. And you only use the random number generator to pick what the target is until after the dream material has been fully recorded. So there's no changing that. So you have to be clear on all of these steps. Then once you have the dream material and you have the target, you send to an independent judge who doesn't know what the target was, doesn't know what the who this dreamer was or anything like that. You send them the dream material, the target video, plus several other videos, and you don't tell them which one was the target. And you have them decide the likeness between the dream material and, all, let's say you send them four videos and all four videos, and just have them rank which one was most like the dream. Now, you know which one was the target, but that independent judge does not. And some experiments, they don't name the target until after the independent judge has done the ranking. And then they show the dreamer the target. So there's ways to do it that are even more foolproof, and I approve of those.
Now,
so that's a standard kind of precognitive dream experiment. Did that make sense?
How many participate in each one of the studies?
Well, so it depends on the experimenter, but a good number would be around 40 people or 60 people. That would be a good number. Sort of the more the better, because then you can look for any peculiarities that might happen with gender or age or things like this.
Okay. And now, what is the difference? And I'm curious, Teresa, if you could comment on the difference between precognition and intuition. So how could you not just have intuition and think
it's very,
same
very
thing?
Subtle.
Mm-hmm.
I would basically say is precognition is in advanced intuition. It's just super intuition in my view. And in the book, we kind of blur the bound distinction between the two. I mean, precognition is just a knowing, a seeing of the future. Intuition tends to be less specific, more a kind of a general feeling. But intuition, I would say, is super intuition, advanced. So kind of like the intuition and precognition. Would you agree, Julia, that they're kind of similar?
I guess I kind of think of it as like dogs and collies. Like intuition, that's like the group dogs. And precognition is like collies. Precognition is a specific type of intuition, but there's other types of intuition. And some types of intuition just draw on subconscious cues you have about sensory events. Like you didn't hear the rumble of the thunder, but you think, it might rain, but you don't know why you think that. So that would be more like intuition. That would be an example of a kind of intuition, but I would say precognition is one of the categories that falls under intuition, yeah.
So there's clues sometimes with intuition. With precognition, there's no context. Have either of you had the precognitive experience where you actually did this yourselves?
Well, we both write about that in the book. I mean, I have had precognitive experiences, not as regular as I would say Julia had, because, I mean, obviously that's her research focus, and that's what she's doing with her dream work as well. But I have had some major, what I believe to have been precognitive. I could be wrong, I don't know, but I had one major one which I believe saved my life about 20 years ago when I was driving and I had an option to turn left and right, and I had this powerful sense that I needed to turn in another direction, and because of that I truly believe I avoid a potential accident, those kind of things. I've had dreams where a few days later they've played out in real life. I believe I had a dream of my unborn son at the time before I even knew I would have a son. The dream I had of the child before I'd even met my husband was almost exactly like my son was when he was a teenager. Things like that. I have had what I believe to be, and I've had enough evidence to think there must be something there. But that's why it was so mind-blowing meeting Julia and the kind of work she does, that these things are being tested scientifically, because I thought it was impossible to test these things scientifically. I thought it's so vague and elusive, and you can't pin it down.
Right.
And it's just, for me, it's a major step forward for everything I've written about. It kind of validates it, because I've written for years and years about these experiences, you know, sensing the future, glimpsing the other side, all these kinds of things. And to see science now beginning to really take it seriously. They're not saying they actually believe, but what they're saying, there's enough evidence out there for this to be studied. And it needs to be studied, because too many people have these experiences for them to just all be wiped away as old delusions.
Yeah, and I'm glad that it is being studied.
You know, the near-death experience you had, you know, the researchers of that now is phenomenal. In 50 or so years ago, before resuscitation techniques were advanced, you know, these people would have taken their stories to the other side with them. But now,
right.
so many
right.
people are coming back because of resuscitation techniques.
Julia,
that they have to study it.
I'm sorry for interrupting.
What's going on?
Julia, do you think that this is going into a different realm, or is it actually predicting a future that already exists? I'm sure you've had this question from skeptics and so forth to say, oh, this is impossible, it's just coincidence and so forth. You are a futurist. So what are your thoughts about that?
Right. So the first answer is, of course, always we don't know. We don't get how any of this stuff is working. So that's the most honest answer. I could now speculate.
Mm-hmm.
I will now speculate freely. So Teresa's right that we both have had, you know, we both have had these precognitive dreams, precognitive experiences, precognitive feelings, compulsions. And that's what got me into this research, just very interested in time and time travel, mental time travel. But part of this work is, well, a lot of this work is about really being comfortable with not knowing how something works. And so the models, I can tell you about a couple of the models that, people have come up with who are in this field and wondering about these questions. And so one of the models is that what people are sensing is the probability of a future event, right? So this model says the future is not set in stone. So when you sense something, you're sensing the 80% likelihood that it will happen. And sometimes you'll be correct about 80% of the time, and sometimes you won't, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that's one model. Another model is that you're not sensing a future event at all. What you're sensing is your own response to a future event. So it's almost like if you think of your brain as a particular system, the brain itself is predicting its own future state.
Hmm.
So there's no information about the event at all. It's more like in about 3 minutes, I'm going to be really scared. So I have a feeling that I should start paying attention to my surroundings right now. So that's another model. Another model is that, like, what's called the block universe model of space-time. It comes off of that idea that arose from Einstein's special relativity.
Mm-hmm.
And that's the model that, look, everything that will happen already sort of exists. We're just not there yet. And so you can get information about the future event, which is a solid event that is destined to happen, and you can get information about that event in some ways now, in some sort of method that doesn't involve space-time, that is a sort of extra space-time outside of the three dimensions of space, one dimension of time, but gets us information here. So those are sort of three competing models, and it could be that none of them are right, but there's evidence to support each one of them, so it's a little tricky.
Excuse me. It could be all of them are right. I mean, you don't
exactly.
know.
Exactly.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
I thought this kind of everybody can do this, but the more that you practice and the more that you get validation, the more that you mm-hmm. get used to working with it. Just like working out in a gym, the more that you do bicep curls, the more defined your bicep will get, hopefully, eventually, that, you know, you just learn to work with it. So if you, you know, it's just, you know, it's just trial. So if somebody wants to try this, they can just start to, how would they start? Are they recognizing signs, symbols? How could someone start?
You know, Teresa's a great expert on that because she,
Oh, good.
To the dream portion, and frankly, most of these experiences start out in dreams.
Okay, Teresa, could you answer that question?
Well, how you start is by recording your dreams, the symbols, creating your own dream dictionary, as it were, and taking it from there. I do think that working with your dreams is a very first step to enhancing your precognitive abilities. And checking in with your and just seeing how these images play out in your life and situations. That's for me. Dream work has been very important in my life and has guided me and inspired me many, many times to make better decisions for my future because of what I've seen in my dreams.
Can you ask a question before the dream state? Is that what you suggest doing?
I didn't used to do it. Actually, I started to do it because when I met Julia, because that's what she was doing. I'd never thought about that. I'd just been quite passive with my dreams. They happened. I recorded them and I analyzed them. And now I am starting to ask questions. I will go to sleep at night and say, I want to have some insight into a situation or a person or what I've got to do next. And the dream images just astonish me sometimes how they're able to provide me with material to work with and be inspired by, because I'm quite a prolific writer. I do a lot of writing work on a lot of books, and sometimes you get, you know, thinking, how do I go forward now? And then I can tap into my dreams to use the images there for inspiration, for chapter titles, for new directions. It's wonderful. I mean, the dream world, it is wonderful, and I actually feel quite sad now if I don't have a dream at night.
Now, how do you...
I get angry. I think, oh, nothing, blank, you know, and I get angry.
Well, that's how most people wake up every morning thinking, you know, just moving on. How do you do this? How do you record your dreams?
Always, I mean, I have a pen and pad by my bed, and I realize that as soon as I start moving or doing anything, really... that the images have gone. So I try, and I've got into the habit now of religiously recording my dreams on the moment I'm waking, because as soon as you start moving, dream images just fade. However, precognitive dreams, I mean, I almost call them night visions. I found that really strong precognitive dreams, they are very powerful, and they don't tend to fade on waking. I don't know if you agree, Julia, but when the more precognitive the dream, the more vivid it tends to be.
Oh, that is the sort of super clarity or super realism or vividness
of
a dream.
It is
a result that most people, most people say is correlated.
Yeah, that was the experience that I had. It was the indelible feeling. It's as if the dream, or when I had that near-death experience, it's as if it was tattooed into my brain.
Exactly, and you can remember,
in colors.
Yeah, it's almost like there's a logic to it as well, because I found symbolic dreams tend to be quite illogical in the beginning, in the middle, end, all meshed up. But I found that precognitive dreams are they've got a clarity and an order and a reality about them that you can remember 5-10 years after you've had them, longer in your case. I'm sure it stayed with you.
Oh, yeah.
You could almost, when you close your eyes, go back there.
As if it was yesterday. Absolutely. Is there a way that you can predict things on purpose, like an earthquake or a stock market crash or something like that? I mean, there's many gifted psychics who can do this. How could we learn to do that if we don't have that, quote, gift?
This is the time to plug our website, which is totally free, by the way, www.thepremonitioncode.com, which hopefully next week we'll be launching alongside with the book, where people can do a training, a method of training that Julie has created, where you can be tested, you can train and be tested scientifically. And this is a radical step forward, I think, in this kind of thing. As I said, when I typically write books about intuition or dreams or whatever, it's the standard advice: record your dreams, tap into your feelings, meditate, etc. This is taking things a giant leap further, and I hope the world is ready. Julia is a futurist, so it is very futuristic, where there is going to be a controlled six-step. I mean, Julia, can you explain because you're working on the website now, that the precognitive training that people can do
in conjunction
with the book.
Okay, the website is thepremonitioncode.com, and what will they experience there?
Right, so I was just working on this last night. We've been working on this for months. It's exciting. We think it's the world's largest experiment of its kind ever, in the sense that, first of all, it's free, so everyone can come in and try their hand at it. But what the experience is, if they choose to go through the what we call positive precog training, so we call people positive precogs who are pursuing improving their precognition to help the world in a positive way. Mm-hmm. And so positive precogs. And the training portion has two major subsets. So one is practice and one is testing. Practice and testing are essentially the same thing, but the difference is when you do practice, your score isn't being recorded. When you do testing, your score is recorded. And the reason it matters is because every time you do a test, and your score is recorded, when you get to a certain level of accuracy that's scientifically significant in terms of statistics, we promote you to what's called the Hall of Fame. And the way each one of these little practice pieces or test pieces goes is it walks you through the six steps to what we call controlled precognition. Controlled precognition is literally saying, now I'm going to put myself into a state in my waking, you know, non-dreaming state where I will sketch out on a piece of paper words and images that come into my head that seem to be associated with the future picture that I will see. And so you're practicing basically tapping into the future, and the website takes you through the six steps, which are, of course, written more in depth into the book. The book has a whole chapter that just takes you through these steps. But it reminds you of the six steps, helps put you into that place. You sketch out your picture. You write your words that are coming to you. We can talk more detail about this if you'd like. And then once you feel you're done, you're asked to choose between two graphs of two different pictures. And the graphs show how much of each different kind of object or thing might be in the picture. So, for instance, you might see one graph that says, oh, there's a lot of water in this picture, and compared to another graph that says there's a lot of plants in this picture. You have to choose which one most matches what you received. Once you choose that, then a random number generator is used to choose a picture and to show it to you, and you were either correct or incorrect. And you can do that as many times as you want. And the idea is that we know from decades of research in this kind of controlled precognition that there are ways that people can improve over time.
It's fascinating because it's kind of like neurofeedback, the way that you train your brain every time mm-hmm. you have a certain pattern, a positive image will appear. So in a sense, when you're doing these experiments, you're training the brain to feel and operate in a certain pattern that could be called the precognitive pattern or whatever it is, where it taps into and receives an image. Could be brainwaves. Have you ever tested that?
Yes, yeah, sure. So there's a whole group of people who have tested different kinds of brain oscillations or brainwaves that might be related to this ability. And it does look like theta, there's something going on with theta, which is around 4 to 7 cycles per second or hertz, and something around alpha, which is around 8 to 12 or 13 hertz, that could be related to this, although it's not in a really straightforward way. So there's much more work needs to be done there. But absolutely, I mean, you're exactly right. You're putting your brain in a certain state. And then you're training yourself, okay, this works when I do that, it doesn't work when I do this, and it can be a long process, but it's definitely a fun process when you get, you know, when you get some information and you look at that picture and you say, wait a minute, I drew a picture of a tire and there's a car with a tire on it, and that, you know, it starts to make sense, it feels really good.
Are you saying that the brain is in theta and alpha at the same time?
Well, it sort of is in all the different, I mean, so.
Huh.
So
wow.
Right. I mean, so the brain is like a symphony. It's playing all the notes.
That is fascinating. It's just like the movie Limitless. I mean, you're really in the state of alpha, theta, beta, gamma at the same time. That's fantastic.
Yeah, yeah.
That's being fully awake and alive and using, as they say, the other 90% of the brain. But this takes work. You can't probably stay in that state for very long because it could be exhausting.
Well, I don't know. I mean, so that's so early on this, you know, in terms of our investigation.
Teresa, what were you saying?
For people interested in testing the supernormal precognitive powers of their brain, I do urge them to try the training and see what happens. And we really hope that we can find scientifically validated positive precogs through this, people who are consistently scoring higher than chance through the training. It is totally free. It's also quite exciting because when you do it, you become part of a scientific experiment. So even if you don't score too high or don't do too well, you are contributing to research into this.
Fantastic, yes.
And you do it in conjunction with the book because, you know, in the book we say now go and take this quiz or now go and try this controlled pretty good notion and we explain it, and just to be part of a scientific experiment. And it's about time in this field that that kind of thing happened, and we moved a step further than the airy-fairy kind of anecdotal
experiential
things that we're presented. Yeah, mm-hmm. I just would really like to see it moving a bit further, because I have an answer now for people. We have somewhere where you can go where we're trying to test it properly.
Now, speaking of time, do you think that it is actually going into other dimensions and tapping into those other dimensions, whether they be in the brain or outside the brain?
Oh, I certainly do, but that's because of my spiritualist background and, you know, what I write about and what I believe. I think that it is going into this another realm of spirit, of course, but I'm sure Julia would come from a different perspective on that, but I'll leave her to give her thoughts on that.
Julia?
Other dimensions. So it is pretty clear. A lot of different models right now of sort of the nature of the universe include dimensions in addition to ours. How they relate to time in this sort of 3+1, three dimensions of space and one dimension of time, sort of physical reality, is not clear at all. So if you're in a dimension that's beyond what we already know in space-time, it seems like that might be orthogonal or on a different axis, relative to what we already know, which means that the interaction between that dimension and what we're experiencing now would be unclear. But having something in the brain that's also in a different dimension would suggest that that other dimension is interacting within what's in space-time, which is within our physical reality. It's not clear what those rules would be. And so I guess I sort of end up saying, it's already difficult enough to think about time with our 3+1 dimensions, and then you add another dimension, and you know, all hell breaks loose. So.
Oh, it's great, though, because I do think that that's where most psychics and people who are predictions and so forth and all you're working with kind of exists. I think it all really exists there.
I mean, there's this wonderful mathematician philosopher, Elizabeth Rauscher, who created this eight-dimensional geometry that explained how you could have precognition and information about sort of future events that are sort of forward at the linear time, but that you get information through other dimensions. I mean, that's a sensible way to think about it for sure. It's just really hard to test.
I love it, though.
Yes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can imagine.
But you can test precognition, and that's what we're trying to do. We're trying to make it available to as many people as possible.
Got to start somewhere.
It'd be wonderful to move on to other superpowers like telepathy and all sorts of other things, you know, that can be tested.
Now, do you use this information to work with the military or law enforcement or anyone if you really can look into the future?
The U.S. military invested $4 million, I believe, in 2014 for training in what they called Spidey Sense, which is precognition by another name, because it can potentially be a lifesaver for soldiers in combat situations to be able to sense what's going to happen. I find that I'd like to research that further, actually. Of course, it's quite difficult, but it definitely is used by the military, law enforcement. I mean, Julia would know about that as well. And predicting the stock market is used in all areas. But we don't really hear about it. It's all kind of hidden and undercover, almost like people are almost embarrassed about it. And I hope this book will go some part to changing it and making it actually okay to come out and say, hey, I'm a practicing positive precog, you know, and I'm proud.
Precognitive and proud.
That's a real thing.
You know.
I love
there's
it.
There's so much well, taboo about it, and we really want to normalize it.
You don't hear it. It's very hard to find them, you know, to track them down, and then they don't, you know, it's all secretive and all word of mouth. And it shouldn't be like that. It's nothing to be ashamed of. And it's because of, you know, the reaction of the general public tends to be, that's nuts. It's not, you know, it's insane. We're trying in this book to show that it's actually very normal. It's just something we haven't developed, I think.
Julia,
it's something we've all got, and we need to work on developing.
I'm curious, Julie, to know if you have experienced any reaction from the scientific community.
Oh, yeah.
This lady is published by the American Psychological Association, and, you know, she broke new ground in her book, Transcendent Mind, with her co-author. And, you know, that was one of the first books to investigate transcendent states. And I'm sure Julia does. I'm sure she's had her run-ins. I mean, I can't speak for her, but I'm sure she must have done. But the thing is with Julia, she's also first and foremost a scientist. And anyone who meets her will know that, you know, she is not to be messed with scientifically. So.
Okay, so I mean, I recognize that, and I think that's fantastic. And the experiment, of course, is going to help because these are going to be random people that come into your world, which is fantastic, and it will help build your case. But this might take a little while. How long have you been building this evidence and the studies?
Oh, sure. I mean, this is just, let's see, I've been working on this, researching this since about 2006, and then my first publication in the world was in 2012 related to this. And since then, I've been steadily researching more and more with this area. In answer to your question, so it's not a problem. Like, it'll take time to build. It's fine. I've got a lot of other projects going on, and they all point in this direction. So I have an app out there called PsyCubed, currently called PsyQ, like IQ for Psy, but it will be changed to Psy3 or PsyCubed soon. That allows people to test precognition in yet a different way. And there are a bunch of different... Right, I can't give that right now because that's not available, but it will be on our website. We'll have a link to that on our website.
Great.
As one of the tools that people can use at thepremonitioncode.com. But in terms of response, you know, the scientific community is very interesting. At the highest levels, the most advanced, creative, high-status scientists are absolutely fascinated by this and just want to know more. They want to know what controls and what rigor was put into the experiment.
Mm-hmm.
But they're open-minded and they're listening and they're interested. At the lower levels, where people aren't as creative or maybe not as thoughtful, there's a lot of controversy and accusations of, you know, you must not be thinking about something correctly, or maybe this is just fraud, this kind of thing.
More like in the materialist world, where they really just look at what is, right?
Well, you know, I don't want to say that it's just materialists, because there's plenty of non-materialists who could be like this, or post-materialists. I think it's more like an orientation towards the idea of, we know all the basic things that there are to know, and so if you have evidence that, or if anyone has evidence that goes against what I believe to be true, which is that time is linear, then that evidence must be wrong, rather than an open-minded skepticism, which is the appropriate way to approach any new evidence is, gosh, tell me more about this. Well, did you think of this? Well, what about that? That's a perfectly fine way to approach any new idea or fact that you come across, right?
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
But that knee-jerk sort of, nope, it can't be true, that's not really scientific. That's not a scientific response. That's more like a dogmatic, arrogant response that doesn't suit science very well.
Hmm. Interesting. Well, it's to each his own. Have you ever explored into the... You mentioned working with the third dimension and time and space and so forth. I've interviewed a lot of psychics and people who are saying that they're channeling beings and guides and so forth that say they hear things, that there is a fifth dimension. Do you know, have you heard of this? Have you talked about it? Is there any evidence around it? There can't be much evidence around it, but what do you know of the fifth dimension in your world? And I'll ask Julia that question.
I do dream work for people where they write down a question that they don't tell me, sort of next to their bed, before they go to bed, and then they give me mental permission to answer it. And then I have a dream with the intention of answering their question, and then I report my dream the next day. And my experience there is that something's going on that could be called traveling in another dimension. It could. I mean, I don't really get it. I don't really get what it is. But in terms of mathematics, there's certainly a lot of good arguments for dimensions beyond 5th, 6th, 7th, 8th, 9th, 10th, 11th. There's good arguments for those dimensions. So
really?
Who am I to say anything about that?
Fascinating, fascinating. Teresa, when you do dream work, do you do something similar where someone will ask you a question in the dream state and you'll write about it
I don't. I mean, I'm more of an author, really, an author about the paranormal and the psychic world. I don't actually do readings or anything like that. I've never claimed to be a psychic or a practitioner in any way. I'm very much someone who's written about it, researched it, and talks about it, really. I would not say that I'm a practicing psychic or practitioner. Although it's interesting, whenever I do media or everything, people always say that. I had once the world's greatest psychic, you know, those ridiculous claims like that. I've never in my book said that. I've just talked about experiences I had that people assume that I'm therefore, like, doing readings or consultations, but I don't, you know.
Fascinating.
I wouldn't feel that that was me at all. I wouldn't feel comfortable doing that.
But you've had precognitive experiences.
Oh, yes, definitely. I've had all sorts of extraordinary experiences, I think, psychically, and I try to make sense of them in my books, and this is all part of my journey of trying to make sense of them, is to now to really explore the science and try to, you know, working with Judy has been an absolute privilege because I've got an insight into where science is at that I didn't have before. And I can share that with my readers, hopefully, if they embrace this book. I mean, it's going to be a challenge for a lot of them because it's totally different to my other books, which tend to be more comfort reads, which tend to not even go into the science and just accept that the people who are reading it will believe, and to talk to them in that language. So this is going to be interesting to bring in, you know, a totally different perspective. But I hope they will see that science and spirit are moving closer and closer together.
Yes, for sure. Now, what is the difference between wanting to exercise your ability to be precognitive and being paranoid for things like earthquakes? I have the same beginning. Same first letter, but explain the difference.
So, have a section about how to tell the difference between genuine precognition and anxiety or fearful thinking, mm-hmm. And there are various things. It obviously hindsight is a great thing. That's the way to learn what is the difference between precognition and anxiety. I mean, I've often had a great anxiety about things, and I think they're all going to go wrong, and then they all go right. And I try and look back and try and understand that was anxiety talking and it wasn't me actually being precognitive. I've found that when it's precognition, there is a calmness and a knowing that seems to come out of nowhere. And there isn't any sort of like arguing going backwards and forwards in your head. And you typically want to take action. You just know what to do. Whereas anxiety tends to make you confused and think overthinking things. That's for me how I'm able to tell the difference.
Gotcha. It's definitely a different energy. I like that. It's a calmness rather than that panic.
It's a call to action. Often you just know you've got to do something.
Mm.
And whereas I think anxiety leaves you in a state of indecision, where you're sitting on the fence and you're backwards and forwards, backwards and forwards.
True. Makes sense. Makes perfect sense.
Mm.
In the book, you talk about the precog economy. What does that mean?
Well, that's my futurist side coming through. So look, I mean, part of the reason that Teresa and I wanted to create this book and the website is because we want people to get it that precognition is not some unusual foo-foo thing that only a few people have. It's something that everyone can access and you can learn to. It's like musical skill. I mean, some people are born with amazing musical skills. Some people aren't born with any, but everyone can learn to play something on the piano. So we are wanting people to get it that precognition is a normal part of human experience and you can get better at it. Most people can get a lot better at it. So given that is the case, if we assume that, then assumption leads to this idea that we could create a precog economy if we decided that we wanted to use this skill on a global basis. And that economy would be very different than our current economy in that it would include jobs for people who have these skills but maybe don't have other skills. If you're really good at getting information about future events, for instance, an automotive company might hire you to predict which cars are going to have to be recalled and not put those on the market, right? Or a hospital could hire you to work out scheduling so that you'd have more doctors available when the ER is going to be busier. So these kind of things that we don't think about now because we say, well, how would you know that? Well, actually, precog doesn't. Precog, a positive precog, someone working for the betterment of the world using precognition, doesn't have to have any of the expert level detail about something, but they do have to have expert level ability about getting information about whatever is the key question in the future. And that will create a lot of different jobs, also related, of course, to stock market trading.
Yeah, that, and, I mean, how to know if blockchain's going to last, to whether or not to invest in this and that and the other thing.
Correct.
I mean,
but we could also use it to help prevent terrorist attacks, right? I work with law enforcement and with a team of precogs doing work related to that right now. So this is something that if it comes out into the open, people will start getting it. Oh, okay, this is something that we can actually use in our daily lives. How can we use this to make the world better? How can we use this to help advance whatever cause we want to advance?
So you work with law enforcement now. Have any of the precognitive dreams come to fruition in any of the law enforcement cases?
So I used to work using dreams. That's how I started the work because I had this dream that predicted a terrorist attack in Mumbai.
And did it come true?
Oh, yeah. But that's how I started the work, is with the dream. I don't consider a dream precognitive unless it comes true. Otherwise, it's just a dream that I thought was precognitive.
Oh, okay. And you reported this and let people know?
No, that was why I started doing it, is I had this dream. It was a couple of years back, in detail with the date of the event in the dream. And I didn't know what to do with it. It was you know, around the world. I didn't know who to contact. And frankly, what could I do? And then the event happened, and I felt helpless, and I felt alone, and I wondered how many other people might have had similar experiences. Just like with 9/11, many people had dreams or intuitions prior to the event, and what do you do with that? And so I think it's really important. That's part of why we wrote this book and why we created the website, to have a community of people who are talking to one another so that when they do have these kind of dreams or intuitions, that they can talk about it and maybe alert authorities. But anyway, what I told myself was, since that dream, if I had another dream like that, I would alert authorities. And I did have another dream like that. And I, through a friend of mine who works in the military, I found an FBI contact. And we've been working together ever since. And that's been gratifying. And the greatest part is when they don't come true, because there's been some work that was helpful on some level with law enforcement, so that, in fact, it helped prevent things. It's actually more gratifying than something happening.
Wow. Have there been a fair share of those things happening in order to validate the experience, unfortunately?
No, I really, you have to get rid of the, so there's plenty of evidence scientifically that this approach works and is helpful. And there's plenty of evidence operationally from the work done with the Stargate program that this stuff works and is helpful. But you really have to try to separate your ego that wants to have validation of your skill from the part of you that's actually trying to do good in the world. Because if you're trying to do really good work in the world, you want none of it to come true, right? You want to give such good information to law enforcement that they can prevent whatever it is from happening. So I'm lucky enough to say that some of what I've offered has been information that has allowed law enforcement to do things that are helpful in preventing other things from happening. So that's good. And sometimes I'm just wrong. And I work with a team of people. Sometimes when I'm really confused or I really kind of feel like I don't get it, I'll ask other folks on the team, or if there's a missing person's case, we'll work as a team. And sometimes we're wrong. So it's not 100%.
That's interesting. But I know that people that have that situation where they're missing a loved one, you would think that they would call you. How do you diffuse all of that?
Oh, it's easy because you have to only work with, and part we discuss the ethics of being a positive precog in the book, The Premonition Code, partly because you have to figure out, is this person part of the family of the loved one? Is this person part of law enforcement? If they're not in the family directly, the direct family, or they're not part of law enforcement, you have to step away, because whatever information you come up with will not be used correctly, or will not make its way to the people who need it. So that already narrows down a lot. Then if people contact you for help, you decide whether you have the energy to do it. And so far, when I do have the energy to do it, I say yes, and I find a team of people who are willing to do it. And if not, I say no, and they'll find someone else, or I can give them recommendations for someone else. So it's just a service. It's just kind of a volunteer service.
My goodness. What an interesting volunteer service. I wonder if you've had, I mean, that is an amazing one. Do you, either of you, have a glimpse into the future if this were really to become commonplace, as much as maybe psychiatry or psychology is today? How could that change our world?
Change it for the better, that's what we hope. And that's why Judy was very keen, because he came up with the idea of the precog thing that we wanted to do. And Judy was adamant that it would be positive precog, because the precogs from the Minority Report movie are not living a very happy life in the pool there.
Right.
I think it can only be positive, really, if people that you have sensitive people who are precognitive tend to be quite sensitive, empathetic people anyway. I've found that. And I think the more positive precogs we can nurture, or sensing the future, to direct the world in a positive way, because that's what the whole point of this is. It's a positive change.
Mm-hmm. I wouldn't doubt that this has been in existence for a long time. It's not like we all of a sudden became precognitive as a human race. Is there any evidence or reportings of premonitions in ancient history or in historical documents?
Oh, way back. Yeah, you can go right back to biblical times for precognition, oracles, and throughout time there have been records of this. It's very well reported. And much more common than people think. But as I said, there's this sweeping under the carpet embarrassment. I think it's because it challenges everybody's perception of what, people feel safe when there's past, present, future. It's safe. We like to feel safe. We like to know. And precognition, it kind of throws that all up in the air, and it makes you feel insecure. So the instinctive reaction when you feel insecure is to say it's not real, it doesn't exist, and not to give it a chance. But it has existed since the beginning of time and will continue to do so, and just hope more and more people will record their experiences, come forward, because it can only be positive, this.
And
we all want to glimpse a better future for ourselves, to be able to glimpse a better future. And if we do see things that are negative, to try and course correct. Because I believe very much in potential futures, but it's fixed, but it isn't the future. And if you do glimpse something that's horrifying or negative, to find ways to change that in a more positive direction.
Just like in a dream, where you go into a lucid dream and you can actually re-correct the dream. Can you do that?
Yes.
You can?
I wish I could. I've only had one or two lucid dreams. It's when you know you're dreaming and you can control it. I wish I had that ability more, but that's, again, something you need to train.
Mm-hmm.
I think you can. Of course, we all have choice. The future is fixed, but we can change our future in a more positive way. Things are likely to head in this direction if we continue acting in the way that we are now. But we can course correct and create another, a different future.
Julia, do you think that you can take a group of people that are responding on the website, doing the exercises and so forth, and find themes? Have you ever done that, where you found several people predict the same thing?
That is that's been a project that many people have worked on over the last few decades. They're generally called dream repositories or central premonition repositories, because the idea is, of course, if a lot of people are dreaming about similar things, maybe something's going on. So far, not very many. In fact, I haven't seen one that is doing things in the way that you would want to do things, using artificial intelligence to look at dreams and intuitions from around the world and then signaling hotspots according to sort of some text analysis, which is sort of the way you'd want to do it. Mm. So no one seems to be doing that right now. It's not very analytical, sort of hit and miss. But that's one of the ways I would like to see the world change, is actually using, let's try to use what we already know technically and gather that information and then use it to help keep people safe.
Yeah, wouldn't that be great if one could gather that information? I did interview someone once that had you enter in dreams and they did come up with themes, but there was no scientific evidence behind it. It was more like a community aspect.
Right, which is the first step.
Yes, which is what you're attempting to create. So if someone goes on the website and is thepremonitioncode.com, can they be a part of a community in terms of events or places where you're planning on having everyone gather? Is there anything like that coming up?
It's all recorded on the website, isn't it, Julia, where Julia will be talking in the States and where I'll be doing in the UK, and communities and resources and the training, of course, that will all be there, and it is completely free, and then there will be a forum. Is that correct, Julia, there's a forum?
Right, so the website has our forum is essentially on Telegram. Our website has a link to our Telegram
channel.
Okay, yes,
we have a forum on Telegram, yeah, where people can, a private community which people can join if they want to talk to each other about it as well.
Great. We'll check all that out on the website, which is fantastic. Well, you are both up to something phenomenal, and that you're able to even communicate and do all that you do across continents is fantastic. So,
the wonders of the online world, yeah.
Well, thank you so much. You've made me aware of so many things today, and thank you for being persistent with your diligence and the scientific analysis that you're doing. It's a great step in the right direction. Again, the website is called thepremonitioncode.com. Thank you both very much. My guests, Julia Mossbridge and Teresa Chung, thank you so much for joining me. I'm Lisa Garr, and I want to say thank you to Gina Salvati, executive producer of The Aware Show, Joyce Walker, producer of The Aware Show, and for you listening. Thank you so much for being here. Your energy makes these shows happen in the space of timelessness and no space. So thank you for being here. And until next time, I invite you to stay aware.